Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. In the waning days of the Biden administration, the U.S. has reversed its longstanding policy allowing Ukraine to use long-range missiles against Russia. The Biden administration clearly intends to escalate the conflict before Trump enters office. What could possibly go wrong? Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Aaron Good in Philadelphia. He's a political scientist, historian, as well as author of American Exception, Empire in the Deep State. In Pittsburgh, we have Dan Kovalik. He is a professor of law and author of The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. And in New York, we have Michael Rossi. He is a lecturer in political science at Rutgers University. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I want to make it clear to our guests and our audience here, there's been, there's been no official word from the White House on the change of policy. However, many players involved in it have already signaled that it is a reversal. So I want to make that clear for the record here. Michael, let me go to you first. I mean, the obvious question is why? How does this help Ukraine, and is this an escalation to trip up the new administration? You can answer any one of those questions. Go right ahead.
I mean, I'm looking for a one-word way of describing all of this, and I'm caught between either reckless or insane on behalf of the Biden administration. It doesn't help Ukraine at all. Russia has been very clear in stating that any use of long-range missiles by Ukraine into Russian territory will be met with a retaliatory response. And Russia has just updated its nuclear doctrine Wednesday of this week, saying that any attack on Russia by a non-nuclear state with the support of a nuclear country and the support of a larger military alliance will be seen as a joint attack. So this does not help Ukraine's situation at all. It absolutely escalates the conflict, and it all but scuttles any attempt by the Trump administration in negotiating some ceasefire in the first days of his administration.
So Aaron, in Philadelphia, so the failed legacy of the Biden administration, they want to tack it on to the new administration in January, essentially, as everyone likes to say, boxed Trump in. Because if there's an escalation, obviously, the optics of it is that Trump doesn't want to look weak. That's the whole point of this. Aaron?
I'm not sure what the point is, because it
I agree. It's difficult to figure out what the point is. I agree with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't see it as really changing the imperative for Trump to negotiate an end to this war. One wonders if it is about attempting to some idea of maintaining credibility to at least keep Russia from wiping out the rest of Ukraine's armed forces before Trump is sworn in or making further gains in that time period. Maybe the hope is that it will have some kind of restraining effect on the pretty much inexorable march of the Russian military. It is a baffling move for a lame duck president to do. And his supporters, who are so sad about Trump, you know, and the prospects of a Trump presidency, which I'm not excited about, but it's very strange that his supporters and all of the Democratic supporters, really, they were so clueless about foreign policy, because they should understand that Biden is risking the lives of them and all of their children and everybody in the world with this policy. It's pretty clear that that Russia sees this as an existential threat, and Russia has a massive nuclear arsenal, and this war was always doomed. And so this is really a strangely stupid move by the Biden administration.
Well, Dan, all the more so is before the unofficial announcement came out, and in various capitals in Europe have confirmed it. The news cycle before, the person that is running Ukraine, I guess the former president Zelensky, told his own media that the war was coming to an end probably early next year. He said that. In the next news cycle, we get this from the Biden administration. So what do you say to Ukrainian soldiers, and I guess Russian ones too, is that, you know, it's going to come to an end. Maybe you'll make it. Maybe you'll live through it. Maybe you'll make it to the last day. I mean, that's a pretty gloomy way to move forward.
Yes. Well, yes, it is gloomy. And again, it's dangerous. And that's why, by the way, you know, Biden announced, or the Biden administration announced, he would make the decision on these long-range nuclear missiles after the election, right? Because he knew this would be unpopular, right? So we knew what he was going to decide. We knew he was going to green light this, or at least the administration would. Let's be honest. Is Biden green lighting anything? I mean, Biden, it was not the candidate for president because he doesn't have the mental capacity to be a candidate. How could he have the mental capacity to be president and make a decision that could lead to World War III? I mean, that should be the scariest prospect anyone could face. And as you've mentioned, his supporters don't seem to care. They care about fringe social issues and not about the fact that the world could blow up tomorrow.
Well, Michael, I mean, what is some of the scenarios here? I mean, again, they're saying that these ATACMs would be used against the Kursk region, for example, where the Ukrainian troops are slowly but surely being wiped out and pushed out. I mean, again, how does that help Ukraine? I mean, that gambit was a failure from the beginning. I mean, I just don't understand how this escalation is going to move the interests of Ukraine forward, or even the waning days of the Biden administration. What are they supposed to say? We went out with a bang?
Well, I mean, I when this was first reported in the New York Times, even the New York Times itself had said that they see very little way in which this will change the fortunes of war. It won't produce much. And if this is primarily going to be used in Kursk, the only logical reason that I could see this happening is that it gives Ukraine some attempt at retaining a foothold within this territory, in some hope of using it as leverage for some negotiated solution afterwards. And yet, at the same time, it completely neglects the fact that every day a town or a village in Ukraine's east and south is captured by the Russians. So it seems to be this fool's venture in desperately holding on to Kursk with some belief that they will have something to bring to the bargaining table. It also seems to me, right, that every time Ukraine comes close to some negotiated solution, some Western country scuttles it. So you have the Minsk Accords in 2015, which we have evidence of the French and the Germans telling Poroshenko, stall, don't sign, arm, and you'll be able to retake that. That didn't work. Then we have the Istanbul Agreement shortly following the start of the special military operation. We were ready to sign to an agreement. Boris Johnson, who seems to be more pro-Ukrainian than even Zelensky at this moment, decides, nope, don't sign, you know, change the fortunes of war. Putin has said what his terms for peace are, and the radio chatter has gradually started to come to peace, come to terms with this,
yep,
effectively telling Zelensky, this is the best deal that you're going to get, because every time that you stall or reject it, Russia increases its fortune. This can only be seen as just another way of scuttling this. I failed to see what the military strategy is, except in just giving Russia a bloody nose before the war ends.
Yeah, well, Aaron, that's not thinking geopolitically. I mean, what's interesting is that over the last few weeks, I think almost all of you would agree that there is a growing consensus this thing has to come to an end, okay? And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, no, we need another offensive. Just as Michael just said, every time someone talks about a process to end this conflict, there's a Western power politician sticks their nose in it and scuttles it. Aaron.
Right, and I'm not sure where this could possibly lead when you say give Russia a bloody nose. As I'm trying to game through these things militarily, and this is out of my wheelhouse exactly. I'm not the expert in like the art of, you know, blowing things up with mechanized, you know, warfare. But the response from Russia, if they were to launch some sort of effective attack into Russian territory, they have said that they would consider responding with nuclear weapons in European cities and or the United States. But I would wonder if they would also be more, or if they would be more likely to just unleash conventional weapons in Ukraine to devastate them, because they realize the only other options would be nuclear escalation. I don't believe that they want, based on their conduct so far, they do not appear to want to destroy Ukrainian civilian infrastructure or civilian populations. But if faced with the choice of potentially escalating to nuclear doomsday or just saying goodbye to what's left of Ukraine, I think they would likely go for the latter. And then how would the U.S. look? The U.S. wouldn't have the excuse to launch nuclear war. It would be clear to the world, I believe, that the U.S. provoked this. This would just be a disaster. So it makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Well, let's be clear, everyone. The going nuclear is part of a possible reaction, but I think we're far from it. Dan, Russia has already demonstrated it has conventional weapons that are very, very powerful and can create an enormous amount of damage. I agree with Aaron. I mean, this war has been going on a long time, but the infrastructure has not been the point. I mean, energy, because it's part of the military infrastructure, but for the most part, it has not been a war of complete destruction of civilian life. Go ahead, Dan.
No, of course not. And let's compare it, by the way, to what's happening in Gaza, you know, where the West is backing a genocide, and not just a genocide, but the destruction of almost the entire infrastructure of Gaza, including churches and mosques and hospitals and ancient sites. And now that's, you know, Israel's moved that to Lebanon as well. It's a totally different war. The reason the war in Ukraine has lasted as long as it has is because Russia has not wanted to engage in that type of devastation. It could have won this very quickly with some sort of blitzkrieg operation, but they didn't want to do that.
You know why? Because they don't want to rule over Ukrainians. And then we're going to talk about that when we come back from the break. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Michael in New York. I suppose we've already given a number of reasons why this is a bewildering decision, but I guess what really stings the most, Michael, is that there was an election. I would even say a plebiscite in the United States. And part of that plebiscite is on war and peace. It wasn't the number one issue, I agree, but it was there, okay? And the people voted, and it was a referendum on the Biden administration. And this is what we get? I mean, it's intensely anti-democratic as well. I know because of the oddities of the American system that there's a break between administrations, but this is a very callous approach. I think most would agree.
I mean, Ukraine is still on the minds of some, but it's no longer a trending hashtag that it once was. And you know, government officials, not just in the United States, but across major European countries, are still holding to the, the liberalist belief that Ukraine is defending democracy for the Western world. And a growing sentiment among the population is asking a very simple question: why and how? Like, why do we need to spend so much money into Ukraine? Disaster after natural disaster in the United States, and the Biden administration just throws a little bit more than pocket change. And yet, shortly after Trump's victory, Biden has secured another couple hundred million dollars to the Ukrainian cause, which, by the way, if it's all in regards to, you know, human rights and defending against aggression, it's amazing how nobody refers to the Palestinians. Nobody refers to the Lebanese. And this is not lost on many Americans.
Well, Michael, it also shouldn't be lost upon anyone is that the Pentagon again failed an audit, but it still found another $7 to $8 billion for Ukraine. It's just really remarkable. Okay, they know how to cook the books when they need the money. Aaron, let me go to you. You know, again, I think it's fair to say even the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the rest of them, you know, there was this feeling that with a Trump victory, that this conflict would have to be wound up. And one of the things, and you know, Dan, you've been on this program so many times, the thing I harp on all of the time, I want peace. I want the end of the conflict, but I want security for all. That's the only way we are going to avoid this happening again. So, Aaron, when is this discourse going to start where, you know, you're going to have to sit down and everyone's going to have their gripes and they're going to have their demands, but every single player is going to want security, and that's where we begin. Not a ceasefire, not a 20-year delay on NATO membership, and all the other points that flooded the zone here. We have to talk about security. When we talk about security, that's when we get moving. Aaron.
Right. This is going to be the way it works out eventually, because I do not see it being possible for the Ukrainians and NATO to reverse their fortunes in Ukraine. And I also don't think that there's much appetite in NATO for maintaining the sanctions regime and everything else. I think that the rest of Western Europe is struggling economically, and that you already see moves from Germany looking to affect rapprochement with Moscow. So I don't think that time is on the side of the U.S. and NATO, and ultimately this could end up bringing about the end of NATO, which is an organization that really doesn't need to exist if it ever did. I mean, the origins of it are ridiculous, too.
NATO is a threat to security. That has been my thesis all along here.
Yeah.
You know, Dan, this, but winding up this war, ending it, is going to pose some very, very awkward questions, like what was NATO's role in this? I mean, we'll ask it. A lot of other people that don't have vested interest will ask it. Will they ask that themselves, Dan?
No, I don't think so. I mean, because I don't think the answers are good, especially because as this thing winds down and the war ends, you know, at least four of these regions in the eastern part of Ukraine will be part of Russia. That's inevitable, I think. And so what was this war all about, right? And then, of course, you know, we talked about, oh, they claim it's for democracy. Meanwhile, Zelensky claims to be president, and his term ran out months ago, and he didn't call for elections, and he's arresting, opposition leaders that he doesn't like, and destroying Orthodox churches. I mean, the answers are not good. This is not a pretty situation. The billions and billions of dollars that the West has spent on this that could have been used for the human needs of their own people, there's just no accounting for that. And so I don't think they can ask the questions because they don't want to hear the answers.
Yeah, well, Michael, there's already been forensic studies of how this conflict started. And this mythology about democracy and every country has a right to join alliances and all this, it's pretty worn out by now. I mean, if you tune in and you're interested listening to people like yourself and our other guests here, I mean, we know the chronology very, very well. And it's slowly but surely it kind of seeps into the mainstream. But I want that to happen because I want people to be held accountable. Like Victoria Nuland, what was your role in all this? All of us know what it was, but does the general public? Not really. Michael.
Right. I mean, this is ultimately what is the weakness of the liberalist theory of international relations. I tend to be myself more of a constructivist. I agree with about 80 to 85% of what Professor John Mearsheimer has, you know, said, not just about the Russia-Ukraine crisis, but also about the limitations of liberalism, in which there is this crusading ideology that these liberalist states will take, which exonerates them of any wrongdoing, any culpability, and if there is any damage to the country that is being saved, it is a small price to pay for a larger victory. The biggest problem that we are going to have to face is not so much what becomes of Ukraine, but how do Western leaders atone for this? How do they come to terms if they lose? Afghanistan was our pet project for 20 years. We gave it up to the Taliban in as many days as we occupied the country for years, and we don't talk about it anymore.
Yep.
And what is the rights? What are human rights in Afghanistan today? They are appalling. They're just as bad as they were 20 years before. We don't talk about it anymore.
Yeah, but Michael, a lot of people made a lot of money in between.
Oh, well, then there's that. And then democracy is just simply a nice candy coating way of explaining, at the end of the day, you know, great power interests, but with a spin. It's a nice brochure motto.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I don't, you know, going into Iraq, if the Bush administration said we're going into Iraq for the oil, well, I think it's wrong, but I can understand the rationale. We're going in there to spread democracy in the Middle East. Now, I think, no, that's ridiculous. It's absurd here. Aaron, you know, it's very interesting. Just today, as I was coming down to the studio, looking at European leaders that support Biden and escalation, but this is a cabal of people that are at odds with their own electorate. Who in Europe ever voted on Ukraine? Who?
I mean, the amount of propaganda that's put into supporting this thing and the fact that the public is, you know, the support is wavering at this point or not very intense to begin with. I mean, it just shows how the policy is at this point in the U.S. They're not even really effective at manufacturing consent. They just need to make sure that there's not any kind of critical mass that's dead set against a policy. It's similar to what's happening in Gaza. The public favored a ceasefire very early on. And we had three candidates for a little while, and then only two. But all of them were slavishly devoted to the Israel lobby. So there's very little democracy in this system. It's a very top-down system of oligarchic rule. And the public is, I think, increasingly coming to understand that it's not really a question of this or that politician. And I think that Trump, with his cabinet picks, looks to be continuing many of the same policies and so on.
Yep.
So it's not going to be much of a change, and more people are starting to understand it in the West. The West is an oligarchic regime that is anti-democratic.
Dan, you know, with the end of the Biden administration, and as far as I'm concerned, I can express my opinion. It's my program. Good riddance. A failed presidency, particularly in foreign policy. But Trump is going to come in, and Ukraine will not have been resolved. I'm sorry, Mr. President-elect, not in 24 hours. It won't be. And the genocide continues in Gaza. Is Trump taking over this legacy? When are we going to start saying genocide Don?
Yeah, probably from day one, sadly, or before day one. I mean, look at the picks that he's made. I mean, Israel's cheering for the cabinet that he's picked, which just encourages Netanyahu all the more. In fact, you know, the reports are that Israel's intensified its attacks against Gaza and Lebanon since Trump was elected. So I think you could start calling him that now if you wanted to. And the other thing is that it looks like Trump's looking to start a fight with China. And, you know, so they used to say the business of the United States is business. Now the business of the United States is war. And it's a sad thing, but it seems like it doesn't matter who's president.
I would invoke some poetry from the last century, and I'll give this to Michael. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
You know, you had mentioned just a bit earlier about how if we had been more honest in our foreign policy instead of candy coating it with we want to bring democracy, that would be one thing. One of the most brutally honest people within the Beltway now is John Bolton, who I usually regard. I regard John Bolton as kind of a discount John Foster Dulles. He's pretty much of the same caliber. As far as he's concerned, he's all in for ratcheting up conflict with China, with Iran. He's certainly happy that Biden has given the order to use missiles in Ukraine. He said we should have done this 2 years ago and the war would have been over. I mean, I'm not a fan of Mr. Bolton by any stretch of the imagination. But knowing what Trump will be inheriting, not just with China and with the Middle East, he may still be busy either doing one of two things, trying to de-escalate this tension. I mean, Zelensky has effectively 2 months to do this until Trump comes in, and then Trump could put the kibosh on all of that. Or Trump could try to make peace with Putin. It doesn't work. You know, Putin has been very clear in what his peace proposals are. And Trump is using the U.S. for three conflicts.
And we'll get Russiagate 3.0 or 4.0 or 5.0, whatever it is right now. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. That fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and in New York. And thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.